gold medalist, and Olympic champion, United States of America.
금메달, 올림픽 챔피언, 미국, Chloe Kim.
17-year-old Chloe Kim recently became the youngest woman ever to win an Olympic gold medal in snowboarding. As a Korean-American athlete, that gold win being announced in English and Korean really meant something to her.
I feel like I can represent both countries in a way because I have a Korean face, but I was born and raised in the States.
Most of us are not gold medal athletes, proudly representing our countries. But even if you're just watching from home, the Olympics are about more than sports. They're about identity, and that can be especially poignant for people with ties to more than one country, like Chloe Kim. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're turning our attention to Kansas City's South Korean community to talk about what this year's Winter Olympics has felt like from afar. Let's start with Dennis Cho, who came here from South Korea when he was little. He grew up here, but he spent periods of his life going back and forth between the two countries. Dennis Cho, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
When you heard that Pyeongchang would be hosting the Olympics this year, were you excited? Was that meaningful to you?
Yeah, I think for most part, you know, I think it was just an opportunity. When I heard that, I thought it was a good opportunity to showcase your national pride. You know, for most part, people don't know where Korea is or know much about North Korea for that matter. And so just seeing that, I think, is a good opportunity to showcase, hey, you know what, this is Korea, and this is a country that you may have used a lot of their products from Samsung and LG products, which have become household names these days. So I felt really, you know, there's a great deal of pride from that perspective.
Is there anything that you've seen just in the various media broadcasts from the Olympic Games that really you felt like captured something about life in Korea that maybe was illuminating for people here?
Well, I think for most part, I'm not quite sure what people's perception is of Korea, and I would imagine. For those that you know are old enough to know, you know, the Korean have lived through the Korean War, have heard about it. You know, it was a very impoverished nation. But now, if you look at sort of the city of Seoul, it's very modern, and it's very just like any other modernized Western city. And so, I think for most part, I'm hoping that it opened. It gave an idea of what that country is like. And I know that through the Olympics, through the media, they've showcased some you know, bits and pieces of the culture. And hopefully that, you know, what they took out of it was, oh, this is what Korea is about. So I'm hoping that would have been an opportunity for people to get to know and get more familiarized with what Korea and its culture is about.
Tell me a little bit more about your own story. I mean, you came here at a very young age. You were just a baby, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes. I pretty much grew up here in the States.
What inspired your family to immigrate from South Korea to the U.S.?
Well, I would say for most part, it's just to provide a better life. You know, I think my parents came here, you know, just like any other immigrant family, right? You know, to provide a better life for their family and, you know, their children. And something that just they didn't think was going to be possible back in their home country. So really, I feel like, I've lived the American dream. You know, I feel like my parents have as well, with, you know, moderate level of success, just, you know, economically and just standard of living. But, you know, the interesting part is when I lived in Korea as an adult, I realized that Korea, for most part, while it was still, there are parts, you know, if you go on the countryside, it's still, you know, there's a big resemblance of a third world country. But at the same time, you know, I go back, you know, and I remember what it was like as a kid. And then I look at what it's like today. I mean, it's changed just so much. You know, then the thing that's really impressive is that every time I go back, there's always something that's different about the city, you know, whether it's a new building or skyscraper that's up, a new bridge that's built, or just something about the infrastructure that's changed that is just, you know, it's just purely amazing.
You ended up serving in the U.S. Navy in Korea, right?
No, here, the U.S. Navy.
Right.
But yes.
You went, do I understand correctly that you went to Korea as part of that service?
Yes, so we did, and we would go there and travel to Korea because that's the area where we would, our unit was affiliated with, was in, over in the Asian Theater, and so I did have many opportunities to go back to Korea and serve over there in the joint military exercises with the Korean Army and the Korean military, and so that was quite an experience to get to know what it's like to, you know, if I would have served, because if I had grown up in Korea, I would have had to serve in the Korean military. And so I got a little bit of taste of what that's like and just experienced that culture.
What can you tell us more about that? Just what it was like for you, what it is you did get a taste of?
So for one, how their training is, you know, the rigor of their training. But at the most, you know, but for most part, you know, they've got a clearly identified enemy up north, right? And so, you know, we focus all of our military exercise based on the imminent threat and just a lot of the contingency plan based on that. And so, you know, one thing that I think when you live in Korea, you tend to forget sort of the imminent danger or, you know, that risk at war, because technically there has not been a treaty between North and South Korea. And so there could technically, and, you know, they're technically still at war. And so while we're preparing for some, you know, any kind of contingent military action, a lot of people, I think, are somewhat aloof or indifferent to that situation. And when I was there, and I myself was the same way until, you know, I would go there and have and go through the training. And I realized, man, this is something that, you know, North Korea's got an army of, I don't know how many millions of people, but they could just anytime just come down south and, you know, there could be a barrage of artillery and just, you know, downtown Seoul could be a bloodbath in any given, you know, moment. So that was sort of an eye-opening experience.
It's sort of surprising to me that that's not something that's more front of mind for people living in South Korea.
Yeah. And I think for most part, you know, and I can see from their perspective too, right? You just can't live your life, you know, in fear. I mean, at some point, you know, they need to just move on and just and go on with their daily lives. So I think so because of that, they tend to, I mean, they know that it's there, but at the same time, they know that they still have to, you know, live their everyday lives. So and then it's just maybe to them, it just kind of becomes in the back of their mind.
As a Korean-American who was serving in the U.S. Navy but stationed mm-hmm. in Korea, I mean, mm-hmm. it seems like you might have also, you might have been in this sort of two-worlds kind of situation that Chloe Kim was just kind of describing, because I'm guessing that, you know, you were there with these, with your fellow Americans and kind of straddling these two communities in a way.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's why I think as a Korean American, I can really empathize with Chloe, and you know, not that I've had that kind of success or glory, that kind of accomplishment, but just from to your point, bridging the gap between bridging the two cultures, and so, you know, for one thing, I did a lot of translation when I was working over there, and it wasn't just, you know, the verbal communication, but just kind of the cultural, the work, just kind of the communication inside the room when we would have meetings and just kind of explain how the cultures are a little bit different and the way that, you know, for example, someone that's a junior in their military ranks would not push back on someone that's a senior in their views or opinion. Because culturally, it's just not there. They would just say yes and then try to work around it. Whereas, you know, I think in American culture, you would at that time just push back if you disagree with something to oppose your, you know, to communicate your views. And so those are things where that type of I would say just passive aggressiveness, it exists. And so the fact that they don't say anything doesn't mean that they're in agreement with you. And so those are times when I'd have to just it sort of encourage them to, hey, speak your mind. And, you know, if you don't agree with what we're saying, you got to tell us. And, you know, so that we could hash these things out. And so there's definitely sort of a disconnect and where I play that role of trying to communicate and bridge the gap.
Were there ever things that you were really excited to share with your fellow Americans being over there?
A lot of times people are asking, you know, what is this? What is that? Why is this way? And
can you give an example?
So when we would go over there and we go to a restaurant, you know, a lot of and the way, you know, out of just kind of the food that we would eat, and I would just explain what this is and how you eat it and how this is consumed. And, you know, they thought it was fascinating. So that's one example. And, you know, just when we're just going around town and shopping, let's say, for example, and I would help with the bartering so they can negotiate a better price for when they're buying just little gift items here and there in the marketplace. So those are some of the times where we spent, you know, where I was able to communicate and show the culture of, you know, the Korean culture to my fellow Americans.
I'm wondering about the Chloe Kim story. I mean, is her story as big in the Korean community as it is just, you know, broadly? I'm guessing it's a pretty big deal.
I think so. From what I've heard and just kind of what I've read, she's just a media sensation. You know, she speaks Korean very well, and she just has that personality, I think, that the media just loves. And so, and her success story obviously is just awesome. And I think I've seen her in several commercials here in the U.S. as well. And so I think it's just definitely a great national pride when they see, you know, Korean American doing just, you know, succeeding at whatever level and whatever endeavor. I think that, you know, Koreans just take pride in that as well, because, you know, Korea itself is a very small country, right? I mean, you look at it on the map and it's just size of, I think, the state of Indiana, if you just look at South Korea. And so there is a very strong national pride, as I'm sure it is in other countries. So anytime there is an opportunity to say, hey, you know, she's one of ours, I think, you know, they just kind of jump on that.
What has captured your attention about the games themselves and the politics surrounding them that might be sort of particular to your experience and where you come from?
So, you know, I think just I think you're referencing maybe the part about where, you know, this year I think North and South Korea, they're competing under one flag, right? I mean, in reference to that, I'm somewhat conflicted, because I feel like I'm not so sure if they're just acquiescing to North Korea, sort of giving in from that perspective. You know, I don't know why they would let them compete together. And while it sounds like a great story, but at the same time, you know, you can't distance themselves from, you know, what North Korea is and the threat that they impose, right? And so, but at the same time, on a personal level, well, I mean, I think it's a great story, because the people there are just, they're just people like us. And, you know, I've got, going back my parents' generation, they have relatives still living in Korea, so, or North Korea. And so from that perspective, I think it's a great story, but it's hard to untie the political aspect of it.
Wait, can you explain a little more what's a great story about it to you? Just thinking back to your parents' generation and their experience?
Well, so my parents still have relatives in North Korea, because my mom's side, her family, their family, they lived up in North Korea back before the war, and then they've since come down to South Korea, and when the war broke out, so they were, you know, they were separated since the war, and there have been many campaigns to where they try to unite the families, and a lot of families were able to connect, and so I was just saying, on a personal level, that it's good to see those two countries competing at the same time. But I just feel like there is sort of an ulterior motive from a political perspective to be able to, for them to compete under the one flag, right? And it's just kind of to acquiesce to, maybe just to appease the North Korean and just the situation that's going on over there.
Yeah. Well, we're going to get right back. Yeah. We've got to take a short break. Yeah. When we return, sure. We'll bring in another voice on this conversation, including possibly yours. If you have personal ties to South Korea or North Korea, we'd love to hear your take on how the media spotlight has represented the Korea you know, or maybe hasn't. 816-235-2888. We are back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we've been chatting with Kansas City and Dennis Cho, who came here from South Korea with his family when he was a baby and then served in South Korea with the U.S. Navy. He's been sharing his stories and his perspectives on the Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang. Hi again, Dennis.
Hi.
You can join this conversation at 816-235-2888 if you're out there and have your own story to tell. But let's turn now to Sejin Song. He's with us from the Computer Science Department at UMKC. Good morning.
Good morning.
You've been in the United States for what, 20 years?
About 23 years.
What? How old were you when you came here and what brought you?
Yeah, when I was 29, I was going to study my graduate in computer science program in Minnesota.
And so do you remember those sort of early days, what you felt, what you noticed?
Oh, you mean the early days?
When you came here, yeah.
Yeah. To me, at that time, Korea was not known much and also not that developed much. But nowadays, it's totally different.
So how connected have you stayed to your home in South Korea?
Actually, I had a lot of my relatives and friends, so usually I still read Korean newspaper through the internet, and then I see a lot of technology development in Korea. Yeah.
So what does it mean to you that the Olympics are in South Korea this year?
This year, actually, it means a lot because usually Winter Olympic was not that popular in Korea, so... this time, they also boom up those all the Winter Olympic sports events. So that's kind of a big thing.
So they don't usually get a lot of play there?
Actually, not many winter sports are popular in Korea, except some like recently figure skating or short track. And those are like because Korean players doing well, so they follow that. But otherwise, not much.
You know, as far as your following of Korean newspapers mm-hmm. and, like, Korean sites online, is there a difference between what we're focused on here with this spotlight on Korea and what your friends and relatives or what those publications are mm-hmm. really focusing on?
Mm-hmm. Actually, something I can tell clear difference is so far, Korean media, they are talking about the winners. So, like, how many gold medals they had. And those things were kind of the focus point. But in the U.S., I found a lot of human stories and then how they come up with all the difficulties. And those things were so touching. And
but that is a storyline we love in the U.S.
Right.
I didn't realize that wasn't universal, the sort of... triumphing over adversity.
Right. But nowadays, I can tell in this Pyeongchang Olympic, their media in Korea has changed a lot. They also talk about a lot of human stories, such as maybe a couple of days ago, one of our speed skating athletics, she got a silver medal beaten by a gold medal by a Japanese player. But they are very good friends, each other, and then they showing up a friendship in front of the media. It was so touching.
You know, that's interesting because something that I had been thinking about is that with the focus on the Korean politics, mm-hmm. the obvious issue is the relationship between North and South Korea, but also the relationship between Japan and South Korea has come up in a sort of subtler and maybe to some people more less familiar kind of way.
Right, right. So, you know, in the history, there was some Japanese occupation period. So Koreans still remember that. So it is shared by North and South Korea the same way. Yeah, but nowadays, Japanese is kind of very close ally, and also culturally, we share a lot of them.
You know, from a political standpoint, do you feel like the Olympics has changed anything, or do you share maybe some of the skepticism there of our other guest, David Cho?
I think this Olympic had a kind of a changing moment for the North and South Korea relationship. Actually, I don't know if it is a political propaganda or something, but I can tell there is like a clear changing moment before Olympic and after Olympic. Like North Korean leader's sister came to South Korea in the opening ceremony. So actually, Korean media, they just show a lot of those events. So that actually changed the Korean atmosphere in the view of North Korea. Previously, it was kind of so annoying. But nowadays, it becomes we know we are the same nation, something like that. So it has kind of totally changed those mindset.
A mindset, even if it doesn't change the politics?
I don't know. It is just slipping now, or it will come up after Olympic. But so far, I can tell that was kind of a changing moment. And then I hope it just goes that way. But nobody knows the future.
Yeah, Dennis, do you want to jump in on this?
Yeah, so, you know, my view on it is that and this is just, I don't know, if like, you know, to use a term about my skepticism. But, you know, once the games are over, I feel like, you know, I think the situation will sort of revert back to the status quo. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if the rhetoric from the North will change. Right.
I don't think the North will change. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't think their view will change towards South Korea or to the U.S. or, you know, for that matter. Mm-hmm. And so that's just, you know, how I feel. And then again, you know, I'm not there. So I don't know. And my view was that, you know, North Korea, I don't know if they're in a position to where they could, they don't really have a strong bargaining chip, so to speak, right? A lot of these things. And so I think they, but at the same time, they're just kind of, you know, to use a term, all just all bark, but no bite. Mm-hmm. And so it's just another, just their attempt to barking. So, you know, we'll see, you know, if what kind of open relation or open dialogue that they'll be open, you know.
It sounds like maybe we just lost Dennis, but, you know, I'm curious from you, I mean, Seijin, from your perspective, it sounds like this is, though, the focus on the relationship between North and South Korea has been at least as big of a deal for people there as it is here. Is it a big deal for you personally?
Actually, personally, not much. I kind of muted to the kind of long-lasting relationship. So we kind of say, yeah, they are there. They are mostly in fear. So to me, I think North Korea is really in fear to stay their regime or the country. I don't know exactly term, but South Korea, they just grow their own path. So far, they did a good job.
You know, I'm wondering if your experience, you've talked about that you think that this has been a Korea-changing moment, the Olympics. Mm-hmm. I wonder if your experience in Kansas City has changed just based on having this opportunity to talk to more people about South Korea or to have more attention on this culture and this part of the world, what it's really like there.
Actually, I'm a computer engineer, so I have some kind of technical point of view. So, for example, this opening ceremony, there was like 1,200 drones. They made a lot of the different shows. And I think the Kansas people we are talking to, a lot of my colleagues, they know that Korea is really advanced in technology. And also there are a lot of economic ties with the world, like U.S. and also Japan.
Yeah. Dennis, we've got you back again, right?
Yep, sorry about that.
No, no. What about you? Has your experience in Kansas City changed based on what's having the Olympics in South Korea and having people's attention on this part of the world?
I think for one, the obvious point is I've been asked to do some interviews from the media on this. And so so that's been exciting. My life really hasn't changed a whole lot other than what I mentioned earlier about, hey, this is, this is the country where my parents are from and, where I was born. And I just had dinner with some of my colleagues from back when I was in the Navy. And we kind of talked about her, hey, you remember those times when we went to Korea, this and that. And so just had that discussion. And it's just, in light of the Olympics, it was just it was interesting. And I know that for those guys, they can say, hey, that's a country where I go. And when we do our yearly or semi-annual military training, that's where they go for that. So, I think nothing has personally changed, but it's good to show that this is a country that where I'm from.
Dennis Cho, thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
And Sejun Song, it's been great meeting you today.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
I'm Gina Kaufman. When KCUR's Central Standard returns, the Folk Alliance International Conference has been bringing world-class acts to Kansas City for 5 years. Now the party's moving to Montreal. So what has this experience meant to our music community? That's next. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now we're saying a fond farewell to the annual conference for Folk Alliance International, the week-long party, jam session, and professional development opportunity that is the Folk Alliance Conference moves from city to city every 5 years. So after this fifth and final year in Kansas City, it's headed to Montreal. So what did those 5 years of hosting musicians from all over the world mean for our music scene? Let's find out. I want to start with musician Michael McClintock. He's with us from a band called Cubanisms. Hi, Michael.
Hey, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Fantastic.
What's been your experience of this conference over the past few years?
This conference has been fantastic. I was here a few years ago and didn't really take advantage of all there is to take advantage of. It's pretty endless. But this year, I teamed up with Aaron McGrain and Bo Bledsoe and ended up doing 15 showcases.
What does that mean?
Well, I was lucky enough to be a part of their private room. We rented a room for Saturday and invited...
In the hotel.
In the hotel, yeah, room 716. And we got to invite industry people. Specifically, it was like an invitation only. I think it's the first time it's been done. And so that was really nice. We got to close that room. Cubanisms got to close it at 1 a.m. And we made some fantastic connections thanks to being connected to Bo and Aaron and being allowed to do that.
What kinds of connections? Like with people who you think are going to make a difference in your career, quite possibly?
Yeah, I would like to think so. We got to have a nice conversation with the two lovely ladies from the Kauffman Center, which is always good. And then I met a couple of nice people who do some booking out on the East Coast. That was one of my areas of intrigue, being a salsa group. New York is intriguing, so that was also fantastic. And then in room 540, that was a room sponsored by Ensemble Iberica in Making Movies. And that room was fantastic. I think that was where I spent most of my time. I think I did 13 shows in there, and I got to hang out with Grammy Award winner Mireya Ramos, Natalie Pietisch, and of course Making Movies, and got to sit in with all those guys. David Amram came around, so just meeting and greeting like crazy.
By the expression on your face when you say those names, I can tell that there's a part of you that's kind of in disbelief that you were in a hotel room jamming with these people.
Especially at the same time. I've worked with all of them individually, but to have that amount of talent in a really small space is insane.
You know, I'm curious, you know, you've mentioned that, like, you didn't necessarily take that great of advantage of this in the past, and now, you know, that at the fifth of 5 years, you hit your A game with it.
Yeah.
And now they're going. Are you sad that this is just a five-year opportunity for Kansas City musicians?
Extremely. And there's talk of already going to Montreal to take advantage of that.
So. Well, I want to talk to some other folks. Let's turn to John Keck. He's a singer-songwriter. And I'm curious for you, like, what's been your experience of the Folk Alliance Conference?
It's been extraordinary. I feel like I found my tribe. It took me a few years to really to get into it, too. I think part of it was because it was so easy for us. There were a couple of opportunities to perform in private showcases that were simple to get for us because we were Kansas City musicians, and the opportunity was there. Some of us were able to get scholarships I guess you'd call it a grant maybe to get into the conference. But it's truly an industry.
And that's easier when it's in your town?
It was at first, yeah, because of some of the music organizations like MMF. The Kansas City Collective is a group of different organizations within Kansas City that got together and sponsored us. So that was a tremendous opportunity. But as the years went on, I realized that it's a job, right? We're there not to play music. We're there to sell ourselves, to sell what we have as a product. And we really have to treat it that way. I think it's confusing to people in Kansas City because they see it as a great place to go and hear music. But that's not really what the conference is about. And it took
What is the conference about? It's about professional networking and
exactly.
development?
Yeah, it's not open to the public. There's a lot of confusion, I think, about that. And the Folk Festival, which is going to stay in Kansas City and be here every year, from what I understand, is what the public... and what really matters to Kansas City, and also that the headquarters is going to stay here. But to answer your question, I think it really is a place that I found my tribe. I hear that phrase used a lot, but it's true if you think about it and you take it sincerely.
Do you mean that locally, like as in you met people locally, or just beyond Kansas City, this
yeah.
larger thing?
What really was a turning point for me is I went to the FARM, which is the Folk Alliance Regional Midwest conference, and that was in Iowa City the last 3 years. That's where I met people that play in the region and are touring artists, and they're the ones that connected with me and made me feel like, oh, I can do this. This is something I can be a part of. This is a community. So going to that, I've been to that 2 years. I'm going in October again.
And so did the conference being here kind of tip you off to that opportunity?
It did, yeah. Yeah. I met some of those people. There's one particular person, Heather Steika, who's a Chicago-based songwriter. She's fantastic. I don't know if I can recommend people, but I do. I did a show with her last Tuesday at the Rhino, and it was great. We had a woman that came in for the conference from Switzerland who joined us, and we were able to present people like that because of the conference, but also... because we're making that connection, right? So
that you're part of a larger...
Yeah, community. And I think it's very unique from other conferences. That's what I've heard. I haven't been to other music conferences, but this is an organization. It's a non-for-profit organization. It's designed to promote folk music mm-hmm. and the broader sense of what folk is.
So for you, I mean, what do you... Can you tell me a little bit more about the state of your career 5 years ago versus where it is now and what you think the Folk Alliance Conference being here does have to do with that?
Yeah, absolutely. It gave me a focal point because I have sort of, this is my passion. This is what I love to do. It hasn't been a career for me. And I'm hoping that based off of what I've learned out of the conference, I can migrate into that and have my passion be my career. So the first year I was... The last day I watched a songwriter named Tim Easton perform, there had been a lot of different groups playing at the closing party, but he played a song called Festival. And for that, everybody should look that song up. But that was a point where I could see someone doing what I thought I wanted to do, and they were doing it well, and it gave me a direction.
I think anyone in any career can relate to that, just in that when you see the example of what the quality you want to hit is, or...
Exactly, yeah. I mean, when you're playing alone in your bedroom and you like what you're doing, it's one thing. But when you get in front of a massive amount of people, all who are extremely talented, it can be overwhelming, and you question whether it's the right thing for you to do. But you start to get a little bit of recognition, and that's been happening through Folk Alliance and the farm. Specifically, there was a farmette last year in Kansas City. I don't know if did you attend that?
I did not. Huh?
I was lucky enough to get a showcase for that, and that helped me get another showcase at the regional conference. So it's really it's a continuation and commitment to the organization and community of the Folk Alliance.
But do you think that the change that you've experienced extends beyond just direct involvement in the organization itself, just to your daily life, to your musicianship?
Yeah, absolutely. It's given me a community that I've been able to focus my energy into. So I've already paid for Montreal.
Nice. Yeah.
And I intend to go to that because it's such a synergy of people who are trying to do something that they're passionate about. Mm-hmm. So,
well, we have another musician with us. She's joining us from afar because she's not feeling great and doesn't want to get us all sick, which we appreciate. Casey Rausch, good morning.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
So, you know, I just want to say, like, you are not just a musician, but you're known for also a local music show that you've been hosting on KKFI. And I'm curious, not just about your own experience, which I'll get to, but what you've noticed in Kansas City kind of more broadly in the last 5 years since the Folk Alliance Conference came to town.
Sure. There's been a great change in the folk music community in Kansas City that I've been fortunate to witness. I've been a part of this community for about 30 years, playing my first gig in Parkville, Missouri in 1990. And so one of the biggest things I've noticed in our community is how Folk Alliance International has caused us to rise up and be our best selves and take ourselves a little bit more seriously in regards to the reality that music can be a sustainable way of life. It, you know, and kind of throw
out. You mean financially?
Financially and well-being. You know, it's Folk Alliance goes beyond music networking to even a lot of social justice issues and kind of conscious awareness of what's going on in the world and how we can use music to navigate these difficult conversations that are having to take place in today's times. And so I see people reaching out to each other more. You know, when I was 20 something in the 90s and trying to gig around Kansas City, there was not a lot of, other than my immediate family who are also musicians, there was not a lot of people reaching out to me to say, have you tried this or have you heard of this organization? And now I see the 20-year-olds of today's Kansas City folk community reaching out not only to each other but to their elders. I see the elders reaching out to the younger folks and really this coming together that it has been beautiful to watch and how we're all learning from each other through this about what works in music networking or gigging or booking organizing and what doesn't work. So there just seems to be a lot more camaraderie and understanding that when you lift up your peers, you're lifting yourself up as well and vice versa.
You know, I'm curious about the musical side of it as much as the professional, like the business side of it. Do you think that it sounds like a lot of people, even locally, have had the chance to collaborate and do jam sessions and things, people who maybe hadn't connected with each other, even if they all lived here?
Definitely. And that comes from roaming those hallways in the hotel room during the conference and being able to weave in and out of each other over a 4 or 5 days time when we're all pretty much living under one roof together. It's like a big camp out in a hotel room. So we have time to spend with each other, whereas maybe when we're in our individual homes and stuff and we have to focus mostly on our own gigs. For example, I have a hard time getting out to hear Kansas City artists because I'm gigging so frequently. So unless I'm sharing a bill with somebody, I may not have as much of an opportunity to connect even with my local peers. And Folk Alliance does that even amongst this world gathering of people here in our town.
Are there local collaborations that have been born out of Folk Alliance that you're really excited about that you think going forward are these are like the musical projects that people will be proud of and paying attention to here?
Yeah. One thing that comes to mind from this year's conference is my dear friend Betsy May, who plays with the Match Sellers and Chad Graves and the Breakfast Sides. You know, she got asked by multiple people, largely locals, throughout the conference, hey, will you sit in on our set? And it's just beautiful to see, you know, what might come out of that in the future from this 20-minute music set in a hotel room of a quick invitation. And also Folk Alliance, you know, on the business side of things, I think it's also added to some of our resumes to get kind of boring and technical business side of it. You know, it's offered me a chance by wearing many hats at the conference between being a folk DJ, a musician. There was one year I was also working for Diddy TV, which is an Americana music television, kind of like MTV, but for Americana music. And so I've gotten to MC stages. So now on my resume, I can put down that for several years in a row, I've hosted a stage at the, you know, the 30th annual Folk Alliance International, you know, music conference and things like that, that will also help my music career because now I've had these experiences doing these interviews via, you know, whether it's a television interview or a radio interview. This is all stuff to put on my resume to move forward in my growth as a musician.
What else do you think that you as a musician have gotten from these last 5 years?
Oh my gosh. It's, inspiration like you cannot even measure. I'm constantly, as I'm sitting in the different showcases, you know, I've often got my paper brains, as I like to call them, my notebook out, writing as I'm listening to somebody else because I've been so inspired by this song or message that this person is offering. So I've gotten songs out of it. I've gotten more disciplined to write more regularly. Those kinds of things. And also just not being so shy to speak up and share my music with people. It helps. That's a tough thing to do sometimes, to say, hey, I make music. You want to give it a listen? It can feel really egoic. And the fact that everybody there at the conference is on the same plane, trying to do the same thing, it makes that all the more easier to speak up.
Well, Casey, I know that you're not feeling well, so we're going to let you go and rest. But thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate y'all.
We've been talking with Casey Rausch. The collaboration piece of this is interesting to me. I mean, Casey was talking about some opportunities to meet that even local musicians who live in the same city had that opportunity for the first time at these conferences. Will that opportunity sort of disappear as the conference moves to Montreal, or is there some foundation being built to continue those relationships and continue those opportunities, even for people who haven't met yet, to still meet each other?
Well, I think that's probably the catch of the whole thing. I mean, it's just, we were just talking, John and I, in the waiting room. It's like, we've got to follow up. You've got to follow up. I mean, it's just like business. It's like, if I got to sit in with Making Movies, who I love, and I got to play my Cuban Tres with those guys, and they do a really nice Latin thing, but I need to follow up. Those guys are busy. They're like on the road, you know? The same thing with the other people I got to play with. So it's, if you want it, you got to make it happen. So I'm going to be sending some emails as soon as I get home. But yeah.
Yeah, and I just pulled out a handful of business cards that I
yeah,
woke up with in my
nice
pocket.
Yeah, that is a nice pile.
Yeah.
But I've got one from a guitar player in Nashville, a 31 Tigers Records out of Nashville. So it's label.
You might need to go to Nashville.
Yeah. I'd like to. This one is from Austin, Texas, a house manager. Another artist from LA who's actually from Kansas City named Julia Otzmar. who's amazing. So it's on us to follow up. It's not the organization that does that. They create the atmosphere, the environment for us to do it. But really, the folk festival that's going to continue to be here in Kansas City is how we're going to make it thrive. Mm-hmm. And a big part of what I'd like to see happen is an audience continue to grow and support this kind of music, because I think it's really important. It helps our society when we introduce these traditions to the younger generations, who only may be exposed to what they hear on popular radio or something that their
absolutely
their iTunes connects them to. So they need the opportunity to come to things like this folk festival that's going to occur. I don't know the dates of that yet, but people can definitely go to folkfestival.org. KansasCityFolkFest.org. I wrote it down so I wouldn't forget.
But, you know, this question from before that I was asking about continued collaboration and opportunities to meet, because, you know, you're talking about following up with people who you met at this conference during the 5 years it was here. But someone just a little bit younger who maybe didn't get to have that opportunity will... Are there jam sessions now that exist that they can go to? I mean, things like that, where those opportunities to meet will still happen because there will be new people, there are chance encounters that haven't happened yet.
Yeah.
There should be.
I can...
That's good.
I can talk to, from my perspective, there's songwriter circles. David Hankin is someone who's active in our community and has been for a long time to provide songwriter circles. There's another one that's in a gallery. Actually, David's part of that too, but it's on 18th Street near Grinders. And yeah, people can reach out to me if they're interested in getting into the community as a songwriter.
Are those new opportunities that have come like inspired by the Folk Alliance Conference, or are they ongoing opportunities that people might just appreciate more now that they've experienced this?
I think it's the latter. They've been around. But now we have this, like I mentioned before, a tribe of people who are energized because of the conference being
right
here.
Like, you're wanting to know, like, the benefit of this thing. I mean, for me, it's just like getting it together. Bring your CD, bring your card, network. I mean, that's for me, that was kind of the big fruit of the tree. So I've always had that in the back of my head, but I need, you know, somebody to kind of push me in the back. Folk Alliance was that for me, you know, of trying to get better daily, to always be prepared and network and be on. But having Folk Alliance, like, a phenomenal opportunity in our own backyard, for me, that was like, yeah, it's time to go. And then having other local musicians also encouraging me, like, hey, buddy, you have a nice thing. You should show up and be ready, like, have a rate sheet. Be ready to have business talk, look good. I wore a suit, I wore a tie some of the days, you know. That's one of the big pluses for me for Folk Alliance.
It just was learning, like, a skill.
Exactly. Just being professional, you know, like trying to work that angle.
When you had other musicians encouraging you to do that, were they kind of selling you on it, like from their own experience of what the previous 4 years had been for them?
Definitely. They had gone consistently and each year, like, learning something more. I think all of us in our circle of musicians had the same, like, the first year we just went, had a super good time, and then each year you learn more and more, like, this is killing for network, we need to go. And then finally we got our own room, invited industry people only. It was, you know, so each year everybody learned, and I was lucky enough to have friends that brought me in, took me under their wing, and told me, like, do this, don't do that.
Well,
so yeah,
John Keck, so much. Thank you so much for being here with us from Cubanisms.
No, oh. Michael. I'm Michael.
Sorry.
Michael McClintock.
Right.
John Keck.
Yes, John, thank you for being here.
Yeah, thank you.
No, thank you for having us.
And we also spoke with Casey Rausch earlier in the discussion. That's a wrap, but you can listen back to this morning's conversations at kcur.org/Central Standard. We heard stories from Kansas City's South Korean community earlier in the hour, and we just said a fond farewell to the Folk Alliance International Conference that it sounds like has been a game changer for some of our local musicians. Catch anything you missed at kcur.org/centralstandard. Later in the week, we'll be looking back on the shooting in Olathe that captured international attention this time last year. It left a whole community reeling locally. So how are people doing now? That's Thursday at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Matt Groby. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.